My name's Ashley, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ashley.
My sobriety date is April 11th of 2011. I have a sponsor, and I have a home group, which is Midtown. We meet on Sundays at 7:30 in Bethesda, Maryland, and we're a speaker celebration meeting. So I just recently celebrated 9 years of sobriety, and that is really like a miracle. It's a miracle for me to do anything that long, but to not pick up a drink for 9 years is and to live differently is what the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And you know, for that I'm eternally grateful, and I'm so glad. Thank you, Billy, for asking me to come out and share my story with you all tonight. I wish I could be there in person. I do enjoy seeing, you know, meeting fellow travelers on this journey, and but I'm also very grateful and glad that we can meet here, you know, in our own homes virtually and see each other. You know, thank goodness for technology. I think this is, you know, demonstrates some of the resiliency of our program and fellowship. So thanks, Billy. I wanted to talk a little bit about my upbringing, because for me, I thought, I thought I couldn't be an alcoholic. And I grew up in a nice neighborhood. You know, we never locked the doors. It was really, a community that was safe and fun and lots, you know, great things to do. But there was always this kind of like undertone of like negativity, I guess you'd say. And I didn't really understand what that was until later in my life, but growing up wasn't too much of a big deal until came a time when we had to go to public school. And I grew up on an island, I grew up in the Seattle area on an island, so it was a really small, safe community. And then we ended up moving to Seattle, and I went to a public school, and this was probably around like the middle school age years. And I I didn't even know what drugs really were. I was that sheltered as a kid, and I went to this public school, and that really changed a lot. I felt at that point I really needed something to fit in. I couldn't figure out like how do I, you know, so trying to mesh well with other kids, and just kind of felt out of sorts a little bit. I was homeschooled for a period of time, and I felt like I needed something to bond with these other people. But even before that, if I take just a step back, I do remember my first encounter with alcohol, and my first curiosity with it. My grandmother would have a martini, stirred or shaken. I'm not sure. I think it was shaken because it had the shaker, and she would have martini every night. So when she came over to visit us on the island, she would have her martini, and my dad would make it for her. And there was, you know, all these ingredients that went into it. And I was very curious. I'm one of four kids. And so I was up there by the counter asking all these questions of what is that? What are you putting in there? It looks so, it's such a fancy glass. I wanted to be fancy. And, my dad would explain to me how to make it or whatever. And at one point he sat me up on the counter and said, he looked at me, he said, Ashley, you have blue eyes like your grandfather, and your grandfather was an alcoholic. So you could possibly be an alcoholic too. So I want you to be very careful about the, you know, using alcohol. And this was when I was 10 years old, I was sitting on the counter. And my dad proceeded to pour me a sip of vodka. It was Monarch vodka, so I remember the little red cup. And he poured a little bit of vodka in there, and he said, okay, here you go. And I was like, cool. And I took that sip, and I was like, whoa, what's this? Like burned as it goes down. And I was like, but I intuitively knew that, first of all, I shouldn't like demonstrate everything that I knew, because I was like, oh, that's gross, blah. But I knew that there was something missing. I was like, that wasn't enough to like communicate why you drink this. And I needed more information. I felt like that wasn't fair. This was an inadequate introduction. But I got my start there anyway. And I always remember that conversation because, my grandfather that he was referring to, the only way I knew him was in a hospital bed. He'd had a stroke or some sort of condition. And he always, at that point he kind of given up, or I don't know if he was paralyzed. We didn't really talk about it much. I don't really know what happened, but all I know is when we go visit my grandparents, we would, he would sometimes come out of the bedroom with the, you know, the air tank and all that stuff in his wheelchair and sit out with us like at Christmas to open presents. But for the most part, I just remember him being in that hospital bed, and they would keep cookies in his closet in that room. And that was how they trained us kids to remember to say goodbye to him. They're like, well, you want to get a cookie before you leave, so say goodbye to grandpa, you know? And I just remember him in the hospital bed. That's, I don't really have, you know, so that was the reference my dad was giving me, like, be careful, don't end up like your grandfather there. So that was the foundation there. Fast forward to that time I had mentioned I was going from this, you know, my mom was a teacher, homeschool, nice, like, community, safe neighborhood to public school in Seattle. And not only was it a public school, but it was an alternative public school in Seattle. And this was, you know, in the, like, late 90s. And there were, you know, just, it was basically the school where they sent the kids that got kicked out of, like, the bigger schools. And so there were a lot of people. First of all, it was very diverse. I grew up on this island, and there was only one other family that was of different ethnicity than my own. And so it was a shock to have this, like, different culture. I remember a friend, he was trying to teach me how to say, like, what's up, and I just couldn't do it. I just was not my natural, so I was, little to say, I was very uncomfortable when I went to this public school, and all these things changed. The environment changed, the people changed, and I just was really uptight, and I needed a drink. So by the time I was 13, I remember getting invited over to a friend's house from that new public school, and I was so excited and nervous, and I remember, like, my palms getting sweaty and my heart racing a little bit because I knew we were gonna drink, and we had tried to get some weed, but we didn't know how to use the pipe because we couldn't figure it out. No one had showed us, so we were just trying to figure it out. We couldn't figure out how to smoke the pipe, but we knew how to drink the vodka. We had this, between the two of us, we had a fifth of vodka to share. And we were trying to figure out this pipe. We couldn't figure out this. So we just started drinking. And I remember sort of sitting there like, I'm not really sure what's happening. And then we went to go stand up, try to sneak back into the house. That's what it was like. Oh, this is really, I can feel it now. I just remember feeling so much joy and a relief and a release. And I didn't realize how I was holding my breath. I didn't realize how tight I was, that I had this, like, spring inside of me until I had that drink. And I just remember the dog being so cute. And I remember laughing so hard, like belly laughter. And I had a lot of fun that night with my friend Gwen. And I quickly established relationships with people based on drugs and alcohol in that new school, in that new environment. And my drinking slowly but surely progressed, even in high school. When I was in high school, I realized that I needed to kind of control my drinking. I started trying to control my drinking when I was in high school with, as I would go to different parties. And some of the methods I tried, I tried eating a big meal before going out drinking. But then if I didn't have access to a lot of alcohol, then I would not eat as much, but I would maybe try to count my drinks. One night I tried counting my drinks, and I used a Sharpie, and I was like, I'm going to just put a Sharpie line on my arm every time I have a drink, and that will, you know, remind me, I'll keep good count. And I was like, don't worry, I'll be the bartender at this party. And, but that night they had made this spody, so there was all these watermelon, chunks floating in this vodka. And I was like, well, does that count? That doesn't really count. And so I lost count. And that night in particular was one that I remember kind of coming to or waking up and realizing, like, I was not where I was supposed to be. And I think I'd asked a guy to drop me off at my friend's house because the police came to the party, and I was like, we got to leave. So I left. And they really just came to the party, and it wasn't a big deal. Like, it wasn't getting broken up or anything, but it was like I left because I was scared. And I went over to my friend's house, but she was asleep. It was a school night. And I tried climbing her, like, the lattice. And I remember, I was joking with a friend, it's like climbing when you're drunk is never a good idea. And I just remember it was so easy to get up, but really hard to get down. And I don't know how I managed, but I found my way back to the the house, and I don't know, it was probably like 4 o'clock in the morning by the time I came home, and it was, you know, school the next day. And it was that day that I learned about the morning drink and what a relief it was. I woke up so hungover, but then just had a beer and I felt much better, and I could go to Spanish class and finish school for the day. And I was like, this is brilliant. So I learned that early, and I kind of started causing damage when I was in those high school years. I managed to, I went to a small alternative school. It was a very small, there was probably like 20 people in my graduating class, but it was a kindergarten through 12th grade school. So there were a lot of kids there. And I was towards the top of my class, but I fell in love with like the drug dealer who got kicked out. And we had this wonderful romance, all through my high school years. My poor parents, you know, I don't know. I can't imagine what that must have been like for them. The trouble I was getting into and the places I was going, and was really no thought to what that might do to them. And, you know, if I look back, my family was going through some tough times during that period. We moved a lot. And so there were a lot of things going on, and I just managed to, to blame those things, or just, you know, it was a transition. That move was so hard, going from that, you know, nice small community on that island to this big Seattle, you know, area. It was really hard. And so I just needed to go out, like, let me just go be with my friends. And I remember, you know, my mom was, she's always big on family dinners, and she did a lot. She, you know, despite all the troubles we were going through, she made an effort to always have food on the table, and she would pack my lunch every single day, and she would pack really good lunches, and like my friends would, she would pack enough for some of my friends too. Like, she always just, food was a big thing for her. And I remember, when there was the day before Thanksgiving or something, and I wanted to go out with my friends, and I was just so desperate to be in that group of people that didn't have, they didn't have like families. They didn't really have the family dynamic going on. I wanted to be like an orphan kid. I wanted to be with the other kids that didn't have families, because I thought that they were having more fun, and I wanted to be a part of that. And I remember wanting to go over to my friend's house, and my mom just being really devastated, because she was, you know, trying to prepare this Thanksgiving thing, and it was a, you know, it was a tough year for the family, and she wanted everyone to be together. And I was just really interested in not being a part of that at all. And I remember I've never been a very good liar. So I would tell her, oh, I'm going to just go over to my friend's house and watch a movie. But then I'd get like all dressed up, because we weren't really going to go just watch a movie. And she kind of caught on. She's like, why are you wearing that? Just go watch a movie. So I, you know, I accept the fact that I'm really not a very good liar. At least to people and outwards, I kind of discovered in sobriety that I have a tendency to be very self-deceptive. So I lie to myself, or I blame other things for how I'm feeling or how I react. And that's different than lying a little bit, I think, the self-deception, but maybe in the same area. So it's not like I can't lie. It's just that I'm not good at lying or telling stories to other people that are believable, and I just forget, and there's too many pieces to remember. It just doesn't come naturally to me. And so that's kind of the damage that I was causing with my family. And at some point, my siblings, I have an older sister, and she went off to college. And I remember she came back from school. She was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and she came back and was like not herself at all. And that was really hard. And I, really, you know, I didn't really understand what was happening to her. And I was really frustrated, and my mom was so desperate for my sister to have some sort of normalcy in her life, because we had a lot of mutual friends. My sister's only 2 years older than me. So we had a lot of mutual friends. And so when I would go out, my mom would ask me to please take my sister, or, you know, please include her, because she's, you know, really depressed and sad. And all I wanted my sister for was to help buy alcohol. I really just wanted her to get me the booze, because at some point she'd, you know, reach the age of 21 and she could buy it. And that's all I really wanted her for. And I remember being, like really nasty towards her because I just really needed the drink. And I, would tell her, I was like, no, you can't have any because it messes with your medication, but like, you have to get it for me. And, you know, not even considering her health or her well-being in any of my decisions. I really just needed her to get me what I needed. And so that was some of the other, stuff that I was doing. And as I progressed, I just, you know, at some point I graduated high school and I went off to college, and I guess you could say I was a high functioning alcoholic to some degree. I would really just drink and study, or, by the time I got to college, I realized I didn't like drinking around other people because for a couple of reasons. One, we had to have enough alcohol for all of us, and I didn't like sharing. And two, I didn't like, the risks of embarrassing myself. I was tired of, you know, I knew that I couldn't control my drinking. I knew I couldn't, you know, control what was going to happen. And I kept embarrassing myself. So I was like, I can't drink around other people. I'd much rather just drink by myself. So I spent much of my college years, in my dorm room drunk by myself. And, or there were a lot of caveats. I made all these rules. For some reason, I felt more comfortable drinking if I was in a foreign country. So I did a lot of study abroad programs, and I was like, well, it's totally cool to drink in Thailand. Like, you know, and I remember having a lot of fun in Thailand on that, you know, study abroad trip. And it was like, I didn't know how to be friends with kids, with peers my age when I'd gotten to college, on campus. I just was like, a deer in the headlights. I could not figure out how to be normal or interact with people. The scenes at the, what are they called? The frat houses. They were like terrified me. There was too much going on. I didn't feel cool enough to be there. And I just much rather be drunk by myself. But when I was in Thailand, I was like, totally cool. I can hang. Let's go to this, you know, and had a lot of fun there. And then when we got back, these kids that I'd gone on that trip with wanted to be friends, and I just didn't know how to be around them when we weren't in a foreign country and like we couldn't drink all the time. So I was like that kind of, I would be friends with someone and then I would just leave or be weird and awkward and stop talking to somebody, or groups of people. Those were some of the rules that I had, and I did a lot of those geographics, and I thought, okay, when I move, you know, then I'll really turn a new leaf. If I move, I'll turn a new leaf. And so that happened a couple of times. I went, you know, first the drinking in high school. And then when I moved to college, I was like, okay, I'm going to try to control this a little bit more. I'm not going to go so crazy. And then, when I graduated college, I moved to the DC area. And when I moved to the DC area, I decided that I was going to cut off alcohol altogether. Because by that point, I was accumulating enough of those, what the big book describes so eloquently as incomprehensible demoralization. Like waking up and realizing, oh my God, and then just really not even being able to look at myself in the mirror and not recognizing myself, and just tremendous self-hatred. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention the experience I had in college. I did, you know, did all these study abroad things. And then I also went down to Florida for 8 months to do this Disney college program where you move down to Florida, they put you up in an apartment and they have you work at the theme parks. And I was working there. And I remember I got down there and like the manager was like, oh, you're so well put together. I'd gotten my nails done. I had my like costume on and everything, and I was ready to go. And by the time I finished that program 8 months later, it's like they had sat me down, like, you really gotta get your stuff together. Like, I think I went from a size 6 to a size 10. Just like a mess. And what happened was, is I was, you know, I really discovered a lot of alcohol. I got drunk a lot there, and even though it was like you get kicked out of the program if you're caught drinking. And I was reminiscing with a friend who came down to visit me. One of my high school friends came down to visit me when we were in Florida. And I just, you know, I forget, but we were drinking, and then we were supposed to stay somewhere, but I don't know exactly what happened. There was miscommunication. Long story short, we ended up having to pull an all-nighter and stay in like a Waffle House or something like that. I could not stay awake, and I just remember being really drunk, and they were going to kick us out. We had no place to stay. Like, we had a place to stay, but we shouldn't have, it was like a mess. And I forget that. And I don't even remember where we stayed, like, looking back. I was like, where did we stay? And then she was down there for like 10 days. I don't even know, what all happened, you know, so that type of stuff was, so by the time college was over, enough of that, those memories that I try to, you know, I naturally sort of suppress now until I'm asked to share my story. You know, by the time I moved to the DC area, I was really dead set on living differently. And I really thought I could. And on one of those trips, I think that trip to Thailand, they actually took us to part of the coursework was learning how to meditate, because in Thailand, it's a Buddhist country. And so part of the international business protocols is to understand the culture. And so we read about the culture and we read about Buddhism, because I think a significant portion of that population is Buddhist. And I remember we went there and we were taught how to meditate by some monks in Thailand. And we did walking meditation and we did like laying down meditation. And we spent a whole day at this meditation retreat with these monks. And we learned how to meditate, and I just thought it was cool. I was like, wow, that's kind of neat. And I started, something inside of me started to wake up. And I do want to say one more thing I forgot to mention. When I was a little kid, I grew up in that nice town, and I remember the first time that I was going to do something intentionally that I wasn't supposed to do. And what I had learned from my friend Gwen, that we got drunk together for the first time, she taught me about smoking. And like, we were obviously too young at 13 to buy a pack of cigarettes, but she showed me how to collect cigarette butts and like take the tobacco out of like whatever was left and then roll your own cigarette. And so I tried that at home. I'd collected all these cigarette butts and tried to re-roll my own cigarette with like lined school paper. I don't know. So I remember I rolled it up and like, mind you, we lived in a place where both of our neighbors were, vacation homes. So like, this was like dead silent in my neighborhood, right? But like, and our house was such that it was all one level. So like, I could have gone out the front door and it was at the other end of the house. My parents would never have known, but I always felt compelled to like sneak out the window if I was going to go out. We didn't even lock our door. Like I could have just walked out the door anytime, but it was like, no, anytime I was doing something bad, I got to get out the window, made a whole thing of it. And it was really hard, even though it was one level, it was really hard to get back in the window. And I could have gone into the front door again. I don't know why. Probably made more noise climbing in and out of my window. Anyways, I went over to my neighbor's house when I knew I was doing something that like was against the rules I shouldn't have been doing. And I said this little prayer. I climbed under a tree and I said, dear God, I know I'm going to do something. You know, I know this isn't what I'm supposed to be doing. And I said, if I go too far down this path here, would you just please bring me back? And, I don't think I realized at that moment, or maybe I did, I don't know, that was an important prayer to say, because, when I was in Thailand and I learned how to meditate, like something opened up, something started to unfold. Now that was in 2006 and I didn't get sober until 2011. So it took some time, but, I'd moved out to the, DC area and I started working and I was working and I turned over a new leaf. And this time it felt like, okay, the new rules, this in DC was like, I'm not allowed to go to a liquor store. And, I don't know. And I dated this guy he actually moved across the country with me, cause I got a job out here and he followed me. But quickly I was like, no, I'm going to try to get sober. I was like, I think you should leave. And I kind of kicked him out and I had stopped smoking, and it had been several years since I stopped smoking. And I was like, this is good. And I was kind of like sort of managing it a little bit, not really, but I was really just working all the time. I worked all the time. And I was really stressed and I got this kind of new responsibility. And it was really hard. And I remember working until like 4 in the morning one time and like the boss was like, why are you working that? Like, what really was happening is I was getting distracted, and I was like, I was kind of dinking around at work, and then all of a sudden I was like, oh shit, I gotta get this thing done. I don't know how to do it. It was really hard. And I just kind of stay up all night to try to figure it out. And I remember we hit this deadline, and I felt like, yeah, I did it. And my boss at the time said, like, you did a good job. Like, you deserve a drink tonight. And I was like, you're right. I do deserve a drink tonight. And it had been a while, but there was this little shop in the basement of my apartment, and they sold wine. So I got myself a bottle of wine because my boss said I deserved a drink. And so I drank that glass of wine, and then another glass and another glass. And I sort of realized, I was sort of pouring it. I was like, oh, I was like, just one glass, just two glasses, but I filled all the way up to the rim. And then, before I know it, I was kind of getting a bottle at least every day, a couple. And then I realized, I had a lot of recycling to carry out. And then, wine, you just have to consume so much of it. I started wetting the bed, and I was like, this isn't good. And I was like, I gotta stop. And so I don't even know what happened with the whole wine situation, but, I do remember that, I had this other loophole with the rules in the DC area, and it was that it's okay to drink if the company's paying for it. So that was one of my rules. And I remember the holiday party of 2010, and that was the game changer for me. So the holiday party, it was a nice party. We went out to a restaurant or something like that, and I was gonna just have a glass of wine to be like a lady, and I got the glass of wine with dinner, and then I had a second glass of wine with dinner, and then one of my coworkers started doing shots, and I was like, it was just like the golden days. I could drink people under the table. Like, I know how to do shots. Like, that's the real me. I know how to do that. Like, I could drink with the best of them, and I was like, let me show you. We started taking shots of vodka or tequila. I think it was tequila. That night it was tequila. And I was just like, and I could feel it. I felt it. And I was like, I can't let these people see me drunk. So I decided I was going to leave. And I did this Irish goodbye where I just left. I just left up, I didn't go. I just left. And I was walking down the street, and I realized, I was like, oh my God, this is why I drink hard liquor. It just felt so good. I was like, it just felt like a huge relief. And so I panicked a little bit because I knew I didn't have any at home and wasn't sure where I could get it other than going to another bar. So I went to another bar and I drank by myself a little bit more. And then I realized it had been a minute since I drank hard liquor, and I could feel myself almost going to pass out. And I was like, I got to get home. I have to figure this out. So I remember getting in a taxi, and then I don't know, he wouldn't take credit cards, so he got mad and yelled and dropped me out somewhere. And then I got into another taxi. And then before I knew it, I don't really know how it happened, but at some point I came to, and I was smoking a joint in the back seat of this taxi with the taxi driver. I was like, what happened? How did this happen? And I just remember kind of coming to really questioning, because by this point I had, I told you, when I was in Thailand, something opened up, and I was trying to follow this spiritual path. And I was teaching Sunday school to kids on Sunday. And I was like, this doesn't fit. I'm supposed to be teaching Sunday school. Why am I smoking a joint in the backseat of this taxi driver? I was so confused. And then, finally I don't know, I figured out, I got home. I was so sick the next day. I was just really, really sick. And I remember, swearing off alcohol again, this time with a solemn oath. I swore to God I would never drink again. And I remember looking out, I don't know if it was this time or another time, but, it was a couple days later after that swearing, solemn oath. We went out with the company again, we were celebrating someone or something, and I had a glass of wine, and I was like, I'm just going to have one. And then, And then someone else came, and so we're like, oh yeah, another round. And I was like, okay. And I couldn't figure out how to order water. I couldn't figure out how to order a soda. I didn't know how to do it. I literally could not do it. And I just kind of gave up a little bit. And I at one point I looked out my window. I was at home and I was kind of pretty depressed, and I was trying to swear that I would never drink again. And I realized that I couldn't make that promise. I realized that I had made that promise so many times before. I mean, the first time I made that promise, you know, I was in high school, I swore I was going to start controlling my drinking. I swore I wasn't going to do it again. And I swore I wasn't going to do it again. And I did it again. And I realized I couldn't make that promise, to myself. And I don't know, sometimes I think of that as like a first step for me of like realizing the powerlessness that it had over me. But I didn't quite get sober because my anniversary is in April. And that was the holiday party of 2010. I think that other drink was sometime in like a couple days after. And what happened was, you know, the miracle of the program, I had been working with someone in my spiritual center. I'd been learning this meditation technique, and you know, it was supposed to help with you know, trauma and stuff like that. And so I was sharing some of my experiences with her. And for, you know, by the grace of God, her mother had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for over 40 years, and she'd gotten sober in New York. And so she'd grown up with her mother bringing, you know, alcoholics home and 12-stepping them. And, you know, my friend who was helping me with the meditation, she wasn't an alcoholic herself, but she had a copy of the Big Book on her shelf, and she pulled it off her shelf, and she read that part in the book where it says, if when you honestly want to stop, you know, or if you try to quit and can't quit entirely, or if when drinking you can't control the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. And I was like, huh, I didn't really think, I mean, it's like, that was kind of a gut punch, you know, like both. I thought, geez. And it says, or, you know, so it doesn't have to be both, but I was like, I have both, you know, because I had tried to not drink, and I'd been somewhat successful. I think the longest I got dry on my own was maybe a couple of months, you know, and then, you know, but I couldn't stay stopped. So I absolutely related to that, because I swore I wouldn't drink, and I had good reason. I had, you know, mental scars and good reason to not ever drink again. And it's not like these horrible things were happening when I was sober. It was happening when I was drinking. And I had good reason to stop drinking, and I couldn't stay stopped. And the other part I related to, and it wasn't every time that I drank, but like that holiday party of 2010, I couldn't control the amount I take. Once I started drinking, I could not control the amount I take. You know, I would either drink so much that I passed out, fell over, you know, got really sick. And there were other, you know, fun things in there, but it would either be that, or like maybe every once in a while, it seemed like I could just have a glass of wine if it was like a networking event at school or something like that. Like maybe once in a blue moon, if I was so afraid of what other people thought, and you know, I'd only have, but I can't explain to you, or there was no formula that would, you know, dictate what side of the fence I would fall on, if it was like just to drink like a lady night, or like a plaster, you know, plastered night. So I related to both those phrases out of the Big Book that she shared with me. And it didn't hit me right away though, because I'm a little, what do you call it? Like when it takes a while for the message to come in, you know, dense maybe, So there were two other people in my life that suggested I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Like within a week of that woman reading the Big Book, that phrase out of the Big Book to me. So I figured, okay, I might as well check out a meeting. But the first time I went to a meeting, I actually convinced myself that I was there because I thought my family members had a problem with drinking. I thought, oh, I'll just get some literature from my dad. He's the one with the real problem. I'll help him out. And totally convinced. So my first AA meeting was Tuesday morning at 6:45 in the morning, and I had borrowed a friend's car to get to this meeting. And I didn't want to interfere with work because I was, you know, terrified about that. And I went to that meeting, and I still remember like the story that someone shared, and I was like, wow, that's pretty bad. And I remember people laughing, and it was really funny, but I felt really bad for this guy. I mean, at least he was laughing at his story too. And I was like, wow, that's really, you know, really did a good job there. Hitting a bottom, that was pretty dramatic, and it was funny. And I was like, wow. And I don't know that so much that I related to the story, because I was like, well, that's not really me. And I just came to get some literature for my dad. And but there was another woman there, and she was younger than me, and I was judging her so hard because I was like, she can't possibly be an alcoholic. She's too young to be an alcoholic. What's she doing here? Like, just judging her and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, but for the grace of God, she came up and talked to me after the meeting, and she asked me questions. She introduced herself to me and asked me questions of what are you doing here? I was like, oh, I'm picking up some literature for my dad. And then she started asking, like, oh, okay, like, what, you know, and we started talking, and she's like, oh, do you drink? And I was like, not so much anymore. Like, I definitely don't drink hard liquor. And she's like, oh, why not? And I was like, oh, it just doesn't sit well with me. You know, weird things happen. And she's like, me too. And we had this conversation, and she kept saying, me too, me too. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. First of all, I was like, you're an alcoholic, like a self-proclaimed alcoholic. Why are you saying me too? Like, that's, you know, I started getting uncomfortable about that, her relating to me so much. And, you know, but I'm so grateful. I mean, that's the power of like one person talking to another, that, you know, today I'm really grateful for that. She took the time to talk to me after that meeting. And I remember her, I asked her, like, well, how much time? And she'd been sober, and she'd been sober for 4 years. 4 years. And I thought, oh my gosh, like, how could anybody be sober for 4 years? And I thought, you know, I could do a couple of months. That's what I pulled together, perhaps on my own. Not in any sense happy about it, just kind of, you know, miserable and really depressed. But I was like, well, she started talking to me about like working the steps and, you know, getting a sponsor or something like that. I didn't really understand any of it, but I had this thought. I had a little thought that was something along the lines of, well, if it worked for her, then maybe, just maybe, it might work for me. Maybe it would work for me too. Maybe I could, I mean, if she can do it, maybe I could do it. And then I asked her to take me through the steps, and like, what does that mean? And it took me a while to so she did. So we started going through the steps, and what we did for the first step is she first had me write my story, and I was confused a little bit, and I wasn't quite sure I was an alcoholic when I first started coming to meetings. I thought it was weird. And she said, well, do you feel better after going to a meeting? And I was like, well, yeah. And she explained to me that, you know, meetings are kind of like medicine, and that the medicine makes you feel better. And so go to the meeting and get your medicine. And she didn't put any hard, guidelines around for me. She's like, well, just go to a meeting, you know, as often as you would drink. And I didn't really, at that point, I hadn't really drank like two for, I don't know. I wasn't keeping track. Maybe I was, I don't remember, but I had a hard time. Like, I don't know how many meetings to go to. So I would just go, and, I went to a few meetings, and before you knew it, I was kind of going to a meeting every day in early sobriety. And, I wrote down my story. And when I wrote down my story, I realized how kind of funny it was that I went to my first meeting thinking it was to get literature for a family member. Like after I walked through my whole story, I was like, oh, I'm the one with an abnormal relationship with alcohol. And that was helpful to see. And I really felt like, you know, part, and I was confused, like, how do I know when I have a second step? How do I know when I have a third step? It's so ambiguous and unclear. Like, what, you know, what does that look like? I don't even know. And for me, in hindsight, you know, the second step was thinking that, well, if my sponsor at the time could stay sober for 4 years and maybe it might work for me, like that was enough of a second step. Like I believed that something could work for me possibly, like something other than my own plans, thoughts, and ideas. And I started working with her and I made myself, for me, the third step was in some sense, it was, committing to 1 year of working the steps. Okay, for 1 year I can work the steps and then I'll reassess after 1 year. I'll just work all the 12 steps and see what happens. And so I did my fourth step and we did a fifth step together. And I remember around this time, so I had about, I think I had like 5 months sober when I finished working at that job that I was so dedicated to, and I got kind of like a cash bonus when they when my program was over, and I thought really hard about just blowing it all on cocaine and just drinking because it's been like a rough year, and I was like, that would just be nice. But I don't know. I just sort of realized like, well, that's weird. Like that'd be really waste. You know, I just couldn't, I was like, well, is that really what I want to do? But I thought about it for a while. And ultimately I didn't. I kept working the steps and I felt like I went through steps 1, 2, and 3 really quickly with the sponsor. And by the time I had 5 months, I thought I was on the 8th step. And, and we did go through the steps that quickly. And I was reading 6 and 7, but 6 and 7, the first time around, it was just reading out of the 12 and 12, 6 and then 7 every other day. And I mean, I didn't quite get it, you know? But at about 5 months sober, I decided with that money, I was going to go to India because I like to travel, I like to get away and, reorient myself with life and just get new experiences. So I went to India and I remember on the airplane, I was like, I had this little prayer. I was like, thanks God for introducing me to those nice AA people. But I think my real spiritual path is somewhere else, you know. Thank you. But I don't think I'm going to go back there. And, you know, this is an example of like of my alcoholism, right? Like I, on my own, will make that, I swear to God, I'm going to stay around for 1 year and work the 12 steps and then, like 2 months later, go to India. And, but you know, for whatever reason, I get to India and, I was doing this volunteer project and I was helping out at this school for, underprivileged kids. And the woman who was sharing, like we had I don't know what you call it, but like we had there were 2 bedrooms and then a bathroom in between us. We were literally sharing a bathroom. And this woman had moved there several years ago and my mom knew her and, my mom had told her that I was coming and that I'd just gotten sober or mentioned it. And it turns out that that woman had like double digit sobriety and had gotten sober in California. And when she found out that I was sober too, we got to share, our experience was, you know, that whole little prayer on the airplane. I had no idea that that woman was going to be there. And I didn't even know where I was really going to stay when I was in India. I just kind of went and I'd figure it out later. Maybe I'd get an apartment or something. But, you know, I'm constantly, if I can be patient enough and slow down enough, then I get to see that there's like a loving hand of God or higher power in my life. And I believe in everybody's life. And sometimes it's a little bit more difficult to see. And sometimes I go through it and then I see it later, in retrospect when I look back on the stream of events that led me to where I am today. And I look back and I see that there's just seconds and inches really between me and a drink. But that there's always something there if, you know, and there's always this window of willingness, but it is up to me to to pray for the willingness that it come, to believe that it can come, and for me to take that action. Whether it's picking up the phone, which sometimes that phone can weigh like 5,000 pounds, or, you know, sending a text to someone that I'm thinking about, or being willing to say, yeah, let's, she said, yeah, I think I'm on my eighth step. I'm ready to make amends. She's like, let's go back through 1, 2, and 3. Because at that point, I really wasn't sure that I was an alcoholic. I really like what some people said, you know, is that you don't have, the only requirement for membership in AA is a desire to stop drinking. And I definitely had that. I had that desire. I was so willing. I didn't want, you know, what was happening to keep happening. I had that desire. I just didn't know how to do it on my own. And luckily, you know, we don't have to do it on our own here. I don't have to do it on my own. I'm never alone. You know, even in this, social distancing thing, or this, physical distance thing, we're never really alone. There's always phones and meetings to join and there's ways to connect. And I've been able to have, you know, coffee with friends over the internet. And I've been able to see my parents who are still in the Seattle area. And, recently I became an aunt for the first time. And so I got to meet my little niece over the internet. And, so there's ways to be present. And I would not be, present for life if I were drinking right now. I, am sort of continuing to realize how, destructive my, well-intended behaviors might be. You know, I can sometimes come off as, a really nice girl. And I really thought that I was just a nice girl that drank too much. I really did. And sometimes I still get confused about my sponsor reminds me that's not the case. You know, I think deep down I have a lot of, you know, a lot of my own demons that I just cover with, the color pink and bows. You know, dress it up, and a smile, and it seems to work pretty well. But what it doesn't cover is like the soul, you know, the feeling. So I did want to talk a little bit about like the 11th step and what that looks like, and some amends. I mean, my amends stories haven't been anything miraculous. I kind of just wrote all of my amends down on the people I'd harmed on a card. And, you know, I'm still working through them at 9 years sober, and I've made amends to my parents. And when I did, you know, they were sort of surprised. Like, my mom was like, I don't think she really realized how much I was drinking, or maybe she was in denial about how much I was drinking anyways. But you know, that seemed to go over pretty well. Most of my amends though have been pure living differently today, and the getting right with myself on a daily basis, and taking that 10th step, like thinking about, okay, what did I do today that how did I cause damage? Because I still cause damage today, whether it's the tone of voice that I use when I talk to people. Sometimes I can get really, I mean, it's not fair and it's not appropriate. And I often am shortest with the people who are closest to me and that I love the most, because they're close to me, and you know, I believe that they love me so much that they won't leave, so I can take some of that anger out on them, and that's just not fair. And so that's why I think, you know, the daily prayer and meditation, or continuing to improve my conscious contact, is really important. And that has totally evolved for me, going from, you know, as I said, before I got sober, I was kind of guided down this like spiritual path. And so when I got to AA, I thought, I've already read all this spiritual literature, I was familiar with all these other religions, and I thought, I got this, like, it's a no-brainer. And I had this beautiful altar and all these symbols, and I knew different prayers in different languages. And well, that's all great. You know, it's like, if you don't know what those prayers in other languages really mean, or if you're not even living it, then it's doesn't really do much. So kind of learning that on an ongoing basis. And I like the concept, you know, for me, it's, yeah, having a little altar is nice, but like the true altar is like here. It's not any physical place. I don't need a physical thing, around to have that connection. And whether I like it or not, the most profound spiritual experiences for me have been working with other women in Alcoholics Anonymous, taking the time when dropping someone off and listening to their troubles and their struggles. I've literally felt, my experience has been that the car will fill with this like very palpable, sense where it's just calm and safe and, non-judgmental and a true equality between two human beings. And that's, I believe, the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, here I started my spiritual journey, going to India and Thailand and these places where there's, you know, a lot of spiritual, history, and really found that the most connected I feel to anything of the spirit is, you know, in a church basement on a Friday night, or, you know, in a school cafeteria, on a Sunday night, you know, talking to other travelers in Alcoholics Anonymous and, being brutally honest and sharing my own weaknesses as a human being with them, and listening without judgment to theirs, and knowing that, there's something bigger than me and bigger than us that's watching out and really has complete control over everything. And that just gives me a sense of ease and relief, that I experience better than alcohol. And if that weren't true, I wouldn't be here. I would not be sober for 9 years, going back to the same cafeteria for Sunday night. I just wouldn't. And I've developed, you know, I've seen friends, get married and have kids and start families. And, I remember when I was first new and I was asking someone, I was like, really, this like AA thing, like, this is what you do? You go to meetings, like, and this is it? And she's like, yeah, this is like what I've, you know, spent. At that time, my friend had spent 10 years of her life doing that. And I was like, that's kind of lame. And, you know, look, like, now I'm like really glad that I followed her suit, because it may seem lame on the outside, but on the inside, it's not possible for me to have these, connections with other people, if it weren't for this program. And I'm, you know, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a deep relationship with my family, with my parents, even though they're still across the country. I have a healthy relationship with them, and, you know, and I now know how to order water at a happy hour. Like, I'm drinking hot water now. I love hot water, and I have the confidence to like order what I want. Like, I really want a hot water, and I've been to some bars, and, I'm in grad school now, and you know, you have to do social things with them before this whole thing happened. And they would even know, like, oh yeah, Ashley wants hot water, and it's not a big deal. It doesn't have to be like life crushing that I want something that's different than other people. And it's okay if they don't have it too. I know how to order cold water, you know? So, that's all I got. I think I'm at time, but, thanks so much, Billy, for having me out. And it's been fun spending some time with you all. So thanks for letting me share.